7704 or on the web at thecorkscrew.com. Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. Learn about Krannert Center's 2006-2007 performance season with guest artists Sonny Rollins, Alfred Brendel, and the Martha Graham Dance Company by visiting KrannertCenter.com or browsing a season brochure.
Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for regular host Inge. Henry Frayne is our technical director, and our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. During this hour, we present an archive conversation with Joseph Grenny, co-author of the book Crucial Conversations, Tools for Talking When Stakes Are High. This is an archive presentation, so we can't take your calls during this repeat broadcast. It's not exactly breaking news that our ability to communicate profoundly affects our success in the workplace, in personal relationships, and in life in general. The question is, how do you improve your ability to communicate effectively? It's a question that has launched about a million self-help books, and probably some of them are very good. During this hour, Focus 580, we'll talk with the co-author of a book that, for what it's worth, pretty much blew me away with its simplicity and insight. The book is Crucial Conversations, Tools for Talking When the Stakes Are High, published by McGraw-Hill. And the authors are Carrie Patterson, Joseph Grenny, Ron McMillan, and Al Switzer, all of whom are corporate consultants and co-founders of Vitality Alliance, Inc. and Vital Smarts. Our guest is one of the co-authors, Joseph Grenny. He is also co-founder of California Computer Corporation and Unitas, a nonprofit organization that helps people in the third world achieve economic self-reliance. He has designed and implemented major change initiatives for many clients over the past 17 years, including thousands of corporate and government leaders around the world. And we'll talk with him about the ideas contained in this book, Crucial Conversations, during this hour. As we talk with our guest, Joseph Grenny, you can join us. All you have to do is call us around Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. If you match the letters with the numbers, that's what you get. Also, toll-free anywhere you hear us around the Midwest or via the Internet anywhere in the U.S., 800-222-9455. We also have an email address. If that would make it easier, you can send us a note, the address talk@will.uiuc.edu. And Joseph Grenny joins us this morning by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning, Jack.
Thanks so much for being with us.
So glad to be with you.
Yeah, and sorry we got postponed, actually, because of the Iraq hearings, but we wanted to reschedule this, so glad we could do it.
Yeah, I happily stepped aside for news like that.
Yeah, or unhappily, as the case may be, but we don't have to talk about that. Let me ask, just to start, in your research and consulting, you have focused on the role of communication and people's ability to use it effectively. This is a major point of your approach.
Yeah, it is. And, we really didn't start out interested in communication at all. Our work as advisors to CEOs to try to help them improve the performance of their companies has kind of focused on the people side. And as we dug in, we just found how consistently what kept organizations stuck, what kept executives teams stuck that were trying to work more effectively together were these kinds of crucial conversations they either weren't holding or weren't holding well. And you know, we worked with one team one time where the president of the company and the vice president of marketing were having an affair. And that's not what the book is about. But what was going on in the team, sort of skirting around that issue, people not being willing to sort of confront the vice president of marketing on concerns that they had with her performance because of this relationship between her and the president. Mm-hmm. The fact that they couldn't confront that, they couldn't discuss it, was creating huge dysfunction and challenges in the team and holding back a lot of the intellectual capacity of other executive team members that could have been pushing with her. There were many other situations where a teammate lets another teammate down and people don't confront it, or other cases where someone disagrees but disagrees aggressively. We just found how often that when the stakes rise and when emotions rise, that we tend to handle these conversations poorly and the consequences are enormous.
Mm-hmm. And we're not just talking about people having an affair, you know, that the emotions are high or stakes are high. Let's talk a bit about what you mean by crucial conversations. What is that?
Yeah, there are three ingredients that come together that turn a conversation from casual to crucial. And by crucial, we mean that this is going to affect results that you care about the most. Could be that I'm sitting in a meeting and a teammate starts to take credit for an idea that I shared with him earlier. The conversation just turned crucial because the lack of trust I'm going to feel in this relationship, if I don't talk it through with my coworker is going to have a long-lasting effect both on our relationship and on any results we could potentially create together. You watch in a team meeting where a teammate lets another teammate down, doesn't come through with commitments. Whether or not they get through that crucial conversation affects both the quality of the relationship and the quality of results. So we've even looked at entire organizations to try to find out what makes them really productive when they are, or keeps them from being productive when they aren't. A lot of people will say you ought to revise your performance management system to try to improve productivity. We found that that does almost nothing. So what does affect performance is what happens systematically and habitually across an organization when someone lets another person down. Do they step up to the conversation, or do they kind of sulk or resent or sugarcoat the issue with them? Do they really have skills for stepping up and talking about it and talking about it well?
And this isn't just in terms of workplace situations, no. I mean, it also involves, or you know, the idea of crucial conversations can involve, you know, members of a family or friends or anyone.
Yeah, about half of what we share in the book are skills for holding crucial conversations at home. So, you know, if you want to get your kid off drugs, it is going to be through a series of crucial conversations held over time. And the quality of those conversations will determine the significance of your influence. And if you want to improve a sexual relationship with a loved one, it's going to be through crucial conversations, not through pouting or sort of jealousy games or silent treatment. And these are the conversations that move results forward in every area of our lives.
Let's talk about why it's so difficult to succeed in these circumstances. Why is it that when it comes to a crucial conversation, we're often at our worst?
Yeah, unfortunately, our bodies were designed perfectly to deal with physical threats, but exactly the wrong way to deal with complex social problems, which crucial conversations are. So when we've all been there before. We've been there with a loved one where the stakes started to rise in the conversation, and we start to feel this knot in our stomach or our hands sweat, and we start to feel sort of threatened. And we begin to behave in these insane ways that undermine what we want. We watch couples where the wife, for instance, doesn't feel like the husband is respecting her, and he'll make sarcastic comments or rude comments, and her response to that is to say something kind of hurtful and angry in return. Well, if what she was looking for was increased respect, this isn't going to get her there. The reason we tend to do this is because literally parts of our brains shut down during crucial conversations. Adrenaline spills into our blood. Another portion of the brain, the amygdala that looks for sort of threats in the environment, literally bypasses our higher reasoning centers. So we come up with these ridiculous strategies like putting our head in the sand and trying to ignore the problem and hoping it goes away. Well, this is what an animal does when it's scared and sort of hides. It might work in the physical world, but in the social world, these are conversations that you either face or you avoid, and at tremendous cost.
You describe, breathing rate increasing and the blood sort of draining from the brain at the very most crucial point that you actually need your brain functioning.
Yeah.
I can kind of relate to that.
Kenny, if you felt it happen. I have, too. I've been in crucial conversations with my wife before where I'll think to myself, or if you can call it thinking, you know, perhaps a sarcastic comment would help right about now. And, you know, I make it, and she gets upset about it, and I think, what's wrong with her? And there's something that happens to us that shuts off access to our higher reasoning centers so that we really think the only two options that are available are either fighting, moving to violence, as we describe it in the book, or fleeing, moving to silence. And one of the most common forms of silence is sugarcoating or understating our concerns. Mm-hmm. Here's one of the biggest messages I think that the book has to offer, Jack, that as we studied people who were extraordinarily effective during crucial conversations, we've involved about 20,000 people to date and watched them as they held these just heart-stopping conversations. Talking with a teenager about a potential drug habit, or talking with a boss about the fact that he's not walking her talk, or she's not walking her talk, she's behaving hypocritically. And they've held these conversations so well that we were literally stunned. We started taking notes about what they did that so predictively produced these positive results. One of the most important things that we discovered is that success in crucial conversations depends on doing two things simultaneously. Number one, being 100% candid. sugarcoating doesn't cut it. If you believe somebody is ragingly incompetent, you have to find a way to help them understand that you believe they are ragingly incompetent. And number two, 100% respectful. Now, it might sound like that those two are at odds with each other, but these people that we describe in the book and the skills that they use do precisely that, 100% candid and 100% respectful. And that is how you get a relationship or results off the dime.
It's really interesting. You know, one of the points you make about honesty and just, you know, really saying, you know, what you think, I guess, you know, a lot of times when we're critical of people, we're either sugarcoating it, as you say, or maybe inserting, you know, extraneous sorts of judgmental remarks that don't really relate to the facts of the case. Because we are emotionally wrapped up into it, maybe we say things badly, you know, because we're afraid of their reaction.
Yeah. Yeah, or if we're in a position where we feel relatively more powerful, we add in our judgments, you know, like, you idiot, and I can't believe that you would do this, or we raise our voice and we're vindictive. And some of these we believe are motivational strategies. Mm-hmm. That, you know, if I raise my voice or I punch this point or overstate my argument or share my judgments, that will help the message to get across to you. That's another one of these insane pieces of logic that we apply during crucial conversations. It doesn't do that. It raises defenses and actually causes people to reject what we're saying more consistently.
Let's talk about the object of these conversations and really any conversation where you're trying to either arrive at some understanding or get something done. You use the word a lot in the book, dialogue. I'd like to, you know, talk about what that is exactly in this thing that you talk about, a pool of shared meaning.
Yeah, one of the best illustrations of this is to look at its absence. We worked in a hospital one time where an individual was wheeled into the operating room and they accidentally removed a part of her foot. She was in there for a tonsillectomy, and they performed what in healthcare is called a wrong site surgery. It's an elegant way of saying oops. And in surgery, oops is really bad. So this woman awakens from the anesthetic and discovers that part of her foot is missing, never to be reattached, and just screams. Well, as we and the administrators of this hospital dug into that terrible event from that morning, we discovered that there were no fewer than 7 people who could have averted that disaster if they'd done one simple thing: speak up. That's all it would have taken. 7 people noticed some discrepancy or noticed some irregularity that morning, something that departed from what they expected, but didn't say anything. What we found was that it's because in hospitals, if you were to challenge or slow down a physician, it's a crucial conversation. It's a risky conversation. Mm-hmm. And people didn't want to do it. They sort of hoped that the next person down the line would do it instead. Now, these were good people and well-trained people who just withheld a little bit of meaning from what we came to call the shared pool. They had a little bit of information that could have contributed to solving a problem or avoiding a problem in that hospital, but they held it back. And this is what happens during crucial conversations. If we say less than we think, if we hold back a little bit of our point of view or our needs or concerns or values during this crucial conversation, the pool of shared meaning is smaller, and consequently, results suffer. In this hospital, just having 1 or 2 people not say what they knew or mention what they noticed created problems for quality of patient care, problems with costs, turnover increased because people could not hold these crucial conversations effectively with physicians. So the whole goal of dialogue is what we call the free flow of meaning, that people are able to express completely candidly exactly how they see things. So if I'm in a relationship with somebody and I feel dissatisfied, they're not meeting my needs, they don't seem to share common interests, or sexually there's some problem that's going on, to the degree I withhold that and don't talk out my concerns, I will act them out. I will act them out by sort of withdrawing or pouting or a sarcastic comment. I'll act them out in ways that will create bigger problems. If we can create a climate wherein I can be completely candid without the other person becoming defensive, now we have a path to progress. So the objective in a crucial conversation is dialogue, a free flow, 100% candid, of meaning.
So you basically say it's this pool of shared meaning in successful organizations and relationships. and the freedom or the ability to each member to contribute to that makes it successful.
It is. All of us have relationships like this in our personal lives. At least I hope everybody's experienced it, where meaning can flow completely freely. There are no undiscussable issues. But we all know what that kind of relationship feels like, the sort of safety you feel and the peace and the relaxation. And you know if an issue comes up, you're able to put it out on the table and get it resolved and resolved quickly. That isn't just the key to an effective relationship at home. It is also the key to healthy organizations. The most productive organizations, the ones with the highest quality, don't get that way because of some elaborate training system or a performance management system. They get that way because all issues can be discussed, because people are capable of holding these crucial conversations and moving things forward.
Let me take a moment to reintroduce our guest. We're speaking with Joseph Grenny, G-R-E-N-N-Y, co-author of the book Crucial Conversations, Tools for Talking When Stakes Are High, published by McGraw-Hill. If you would like to join our conversation, you can do so by calling us around Champaign-Urbana at 333-9455. Toll-free anywhere else, 800-222-9455. Also, happy to take your question by email, the address talk@will.uiuc.edu. Well, let's talk a bit about technique, because it's easy to say, yes, we want to make it safe for people to express their points of view, to add to the pool of shared meaning. But how do we do that?
Yeah. The first and most important principle that we teach in the book is sort of getting your emotions under control. There are two principles for that. The first one we call start with heart. It turns out the first thing that degenerates when we're in crucial conversations is not our behavior, it's our motives. We start wanting the wrong things. We start wanting to be right, or just to keep the peace, or to look good, or save face. So my teenager comes in and says, you know, she wants to use the car, and I say, well, no, you're not going to be able to. And she says, Dad, you know, you're a control freak, and I hate your guts. And the conversation just turned crucial. The challenge during times like that, when we start to feel provoked or attacked, is to stop and examine our motives. What we start to want at that moment is to punish or to get back or to be in control or to save face. And those will cause behavior from us that are going to exactly undermine those desires. We will not save face. We will not be in control. We will not look good. And we won't even keep the peace. So the skill that we've watched these extremely skillful people use is to stop and to examine their motives. They stop and ask themselves, what do I really want here? What do I really want for me? What do I really want for the other person? And what do I really want for the relationship? To the degree I'm clear on my goals coming into a crucial conversation, I'll be less controlled by my fears. So getting some quiet clarity in my heart about the positive results I want to create for myself and the other person really gives me a shield against defensiveness to some degree when I come into the conversation. So if I come into a conversation with my boss wanting to share with him my concerns about how he's micromanaging me, I need to be absolutely clear coming in that my goal is not to sort of keep the peace and or save face or look good in this. That isn't it at all. What I really want is to create an environment where I can perform at my best, and I really want for me to have a really positive and trusting relationship with the boss. That's what I want. That's what I really want. If I'm clear on that coming into the conversation, I'm much more likely to draw on some of the other skills that I'll learn out of the book.
What happens too often is that you start the conversation with that objective in mind, and then things start to go awry, the conversation turns crucial, and sort of just lose your focus.
Yes, you do. And the second principle that we teach in the book is called learn to look. There are skills that we teach. What we noticed about these really effective people during crucial conversations is they give their mind something to do. They give it a task. And one of the best tasks to give it is to watch for signs of silence and violence. There are six different behaviors to watch for. And you watch both yourself and the other person to see, am I starting to label here? Or am I moving to masking? Have I gone over to attacking? There are a number of different kinds of behaviors, and if we're attentive to those, we can literally catch ourselves more quickly and move the conversation back toward dialogue. If we stop looking for those behaviors, then we can get so far off track that getting back to dialogue is incredibly costly and challenging and also very difficult. So learning to look is a second skill. One of the best things to look for, in fact, advice that I'd give to your listeners here is for your own style under stress. In the book, there's what we call a style under stress test. It's also available on a website at crucialconversations.com for free. And that style under stress test will help you see what your tendencies are that are undermining your effectiveness in a crucial conversation. If you're aware of those coming in, you're much more likely to catch yourself before you start moving in a negative direction.
Mm-hmm. So it's good to sort of, in advance, get to know your own sort of reactions to these situations so you can look for those.
Yeah, the Oracle at Delphi says, know thyself. This is the beginning of knowledge. So if you can know what your natural tendencies will be, with my children, for example, my style under stress is control. Mm-hmm. So I start overstating my point or dominating the conversation with questions and so forth. Just being conscious of that has been so valuable to me in catching myself as I start to deal with the discipline problem with them, so I can keep it in dialogue as opposed to monologue.
You mentioned that, the two terms that you've used, the behaviors, silence and violence. Let's talk a little bit about what those are. It's not, violence meaning you're actually going to hit somebody necessarily, but it's a kind of verbal behavior or psychological behavior in some sense.
Yeah, that's an important distinction. And although we do find that physical violence is preceded by some of these other violence behaviors as well. So we start to, on the violence path, move to controlling. Now, here's the critical change that happens inside of us. When I'm in a conversation with a colleague trying to make a decision about how we're going to spend our budget money, we might start in dialogue. But as they start to oppose me on things that are very important to me, I might make this shift towards controlling. And as I do, my goal is no longer the free flow of meaning. My goal now is to convince or compel or control that other person toward my point of view. That's a fateful shift. So that's kind of the first level of violence to move to. Here's what we do. We start to overstate our point, or we start to speak in absolutes. The fact of the matter is, or as every thinking person knows. And what's tragic about that shift is that the more convincing we try to be, the less convincing we are.
Mm-hmm.
The more we try to compel others to our point of view, the more we provoke resistance on their part, and we actually become less influential. So if we want to be more convincing, try to be less convincing, at least when people are opposing you. So controlling is the first sort of form of violence. Second is labeling. Well, we can sometimes label without even using labels. Labels are name-calling. We could just roll our eyes or sort of not make eye contact or shake our head in a condescending way, and there's an implied "you idiot" at the end of this. And so labeling starts to move to either nonverbal or verbal sort of dismissal of the other person's ideas. And finally, we move to attacking. And the goal here is to punish. I don't even care about getting results anymore. All I care about is causing pain to the other person. And attacking, then, is the prelude to even more aggressive forms of violence like we see around the world today. So these are different forms of violence to watch for, and that if we can catch ourselves more quickly in them, we can actually move back to dialogue much more effectively.
I was just going to say, you see a lot of this kind of behavior in politics.
You sure do, and it's just really tragic. I just finished reading John Adams' biography, and it was just made my heart ache again to see how quickly we degenerated from this wonderful unity at the time of the revolution in this country to where we started this party warfare that continues to this day. And so much of our public discourse is petty attacking, it's labeling, it's overstating our points. Half of what I listen to on talk radio these days, I scratch my head and I think, does the radio host even believe what he's saying? It's so overstated and so over the top that it just shuts down the opportunity for rational and intelligent consideration.
Well, maybe we'll return to politics later on in the show, but about at our midpoint, let me mention again, we're talking with Joseph Grenny, co-author of the book Crucial Conversations, Tools for Talking When Stakes Are High, recently published in paperback by McGraw-Hill. And if you'd like to join our conversation, you can do so by calling us. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL, toll-free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-WILL. And I'll just go on and ask my own questions. There's a point you make about safety in these conversations, and you basically state that when it's unsafe, and let's talk about what that means, you start to go blind.
Yes. Yeah, I think the most important idea in the entire book, in fact, if your listeners were able to get, understand, and embrace just one concept in the book, it is that what predicts success in a crucial conversation, our ability to talk about anything, is dependent on our capacity to create safety. If people feel safe, they can talk about anything. All of us have been in conversations before where we felt safe enough that even though someone was giving us negative feedback or criticizing us for some reason, we were able to absorb it. And what we've had the opportunity to study is what people do consciously and intentionally to create safety so that others will not become defensive. There are three skills we describe in the book that all of us sort of use unconsciously at times. But those who are really good at crucial conversations are very conscious of the need to do this. If you can help someone feel safe, they can hear anything from you without becoming defensive. So that is really sort of the superordinate principle here, the overarching one in all of crucial conversations.
We have a caller to talk with, and we could talk more about that issue, but let's see what this person would like to discuss. A listener in Urbana on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yeah, actually, my question relates to what you're just talking about, because, for example, earlier this year, a lady called Joyce Rothschild, a professor of sociology at Virginia Tech, let me quote from this press release. She did an 8-year study conducting in-depth interviews with 300 whistleblowers and more than 200 surveys of silent observers, people who observed some wrongdoing but who chose to remain silent. She found that 69% were fired as a result of exposing wrongdoing, even when they only reported this wrongdoing to higher-ups within their own employer's organization, unquote. And my point is that seems as if you need to write a companion volume having to do with how to get people to listen to straight up talk, because the most organizations are saddled with these notions of team playing, which does not include any kind of negative feedback. They're saddled with ideas of image versus substance. So if you could talk about that a little bit, and I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Okay, thanks for the point.
And he's making a wonderful point, actually a couple of them there. One of the interesting crucial conversations we had a chance to watch a few years back or participate in was a CEO who began to be concerned that her CFO was embezzling from the company. You talk about a crucial conversation, and he talks about the notion of whistleblowers. This CEO began to have these concerns, and you think about in most companies when somebody would have a concern like that, how it would be handled. Most would say nothing, or if they were the CEO, they might start a sort of surreptitious audit and see if they could build a case against them and so forth. Well, this CEO sat down with her CFO and shared the concerns, laid them out very candidly, and did so in a way, surprisingly enough, that there was minimal defensiveness. The CFO, in fact, understood, given the data that she laid out, why she would have this concern. Now, fortunately, in this case, there was no malicious motive. There were irregularities. There were some competence issues that needed to be corrected. And the CFO walked out having been counseled about these. The CEO walked out feeling satisfied that she had a well-intended CFO, albeit a bit naive in some areas. And the two of them actually had a stronger relationship at the end than at the beginning. When you see cases where there's gross kinds of financial misappropriation or misconduct in organizations, it is not the story of a board that sat down and everyone said, all in favor of screwing the shareholders, raise your arm to the square. These are usually things that start small. and there are little irregularities that occur, and nobody steps up to the crucial conversation with them. The path toward higher ethical standards in organizations is not even through a handful of whistleblowers. Whistleblowing is something that has to happen way too late in the game. It happens when people start to make a little bit of a moral left turn, and others around them are skillful enough and effective enough that they can bring them back into line and encourage and counsel them. So the real long-term success, our ability long-term to keep capitalism from its abuses, is really fundamentally dependent upon our capacity to be able to raise these crucial conversations at the time that they occur and before they become well-entrenched habits and patterns. And we've actually hired outsiders, like you hear examples of at Global Crossing, intentionally to have come in and do these terrible kinds of things.
I want to talk about the importance of stories that we tell ourselves about things, because this seems like a good point maybe to raise this. Mm. We often see a fact, whether it's something that we see wrong going on or maybe something right, doesn't matter. Whatever facts we see, we always give those a spin and tell ourselves a story, and those stories are what often gets us into trouble.
It's so true. A lot of us, when we're thinking about crucial conversations that we face, are thinking about the boiling emotions we feel, and these are the reason that we are so unsuccessful often in creating safety and effectively holding the crucial conversation. So we've had to dig underneath that. We've watched people, for instance, we watched a woman talk to a colleague one time, a peer of hers, about a concern she had that every time he'd come into the office and was talking to her, his eyes would sort of drift from her eyes down to her chest and occasionally would rest there as the two of them were talking literally 2 feet apart. And this made her really uncomfortable, and she at first tried to send some nonverbal signals like folding her arms or sort of crouching down 6 inches to get his eyes back in line. And for some reason, none of this was communicating to this guy. Well, after 4 or 5 weeks of working together and this behavior continuing and her feeling just really irritated and bothered with him, she finally decided, I'm going to need to have a crucial conversation with him. I need to raise and confront this issue. So here's the problem. She is disgusted with this guy. She thinks he's a lecher. She sees a wedding ring on his left hand, and she thinks, well, what kind of a loser are you, pawing people with your eyes here in the office? If in that sort of affect she opens this crucial conversation, she can predict disaster. He is going to be defensive. He is going to feel attacked. He is going to go into denial. And if anything, he'll walk out of the conversation sort of blaming and bad-mouthing her and probably undermining her relationships with others in the workplace. And this is not what she wants. Well, this woman was able to walk into this conversation so effectively that we wondered why. Why did she come across so professionally and tactfully? Well, here's what she taught us. She said, whenever I feel angry or disgusted or fearful, I get underneath those emotions and look for the story I'm telling myself. Well, we said, what do you mean by story? She said, the issue is not his behavior. It's the story I tell myself about his behavior, the judgments I add to it. What we found during crucial conversations is there are always two kinds of stories we tell ourselves. This guy's eyes are focusing on my chest right now. And the first kind of story I tell myself about that is a villain story. I take what he's doing and focus exclusively on that, exaggerate it all out of proportion, and tell myself he's a lecher, he's disgusting, he's doing this intentionally, he's trying to show disrespect to me, or even in a worst-case scenario, this is a power thing that he's doing. Well, I don't know that any of that is true, but I tell myself this story, and it creates an emotion called anger. The second story I have to tell myself is a victim story. And that's one that makes me powerless and sort of a hapless victim of this circumstance. Well, in her case, the victim story she told herself was, I'm not doing anything. I'm not trying to dress provocatively. In fact, I've tried to send nonverbal signals, and he's intentionally ignoring them. And so she takes herself off the hook for any participation in this sort of chronic problem. Well, these victim and villain stories are what create the angry or fearful emotions that we feel in crucial conversations, and until we can get underneath them, we'll never be able to feel emotions that are conducive to a healthy dialogue.
So basically, you look for the facts. What are the facts? Not just the stories. What are the facts that support those stories?
Correct. And the only facts she had were, this guy has a habit of his eyes sort of drifting downward and staring at my chest while we're talking. And the rest of the emotion she had was all about the story she told herself about it. She assumed it was sexual. She assumed he was doing it on purpose. She assumed it was predatory. She assumed that she had no role in the interaction. Well, the way she created some healthier emotions for herself was by asking two very challenging questions that we present in the book. The first is, she asked herself, why would a reasonable, rational, and decent person be doing this? That's a hard one to ask when you've already decided they're not reasonable, rational, or decent.
Right.
Why would a reasonable, rational, or decent person do this? Well, here's where she ended up. She said, I guess something I've never considered is, I wonder if he does this with others. I wonder if it's just me, or if it's even just women, or if it's just, well, maybe there's something else behind this. The second question that she asked herself is, what am I pretending not to know about my role in creating this problem? What am I pretending not to know about my role? That's how I get myself out of the victim role and say, am I playing a role here? Well, as she asked herself that question, she didn't feel accountable for his staring at her chest. What she did feel accountable for was that she had been putting off for weeks and weeks mentioning anything to him. She said half of her anger at him was actually guilt from her sort of selling out and not confronting the issue until she was really, really angry. So she took ownership for that. All right, I've put it off too long, and I need to sort of say mea culpa for that, and I'm going to do it. So two things she did. One was, looking for how a reasonable, rational, and decent person, a different story she might create out of this predicament. Well, what she began to do was watch him as he interacted with other people. She watched him particularly with men. And she noticed that he would make eye contact for a few seconds, and then his eyes would drift down about chest level. Well, this kind of puzzled her. She wondered what was going on with that, and she started softening her view a little bit. Well, eventually, when she talked to him and shared her concerns, she was able to get through the conversation enough and realize that this guy was just very uncomfortable with sort of close social distance. It wasn't a male-female thing. She shared with him, though, her concern that others might be feeling the same way, and he actually was sort of startled and embarrassed but grateful and said, I'm sorry I'm doing this, and never did it again. Complete eye contact, or he'd look off to the right as the two of them talked.
Right.
So here's an example of how very often the behavior or the facts can be spun into some really huge story, create angry emotions for ourselves that we act on during a crucial conversation, and actually make matters worse.
Now, one has to ask, what if the guy was actually a lech? And what if he was, you know, doing a power play and sort of, you know, being, you know, engaging in sexual harassment behavior?
Yes. Then phase one should still be a crucial conversation. If it's possible for us to give the benefit of the doubt just as far as that conversation goes, give the counseling, get the commitment from the individual that he is not going to be doing this anymore, then if the behavior continues, it's appropriate either to have another crucial conversation saying you're not keeping your commitment and my next step is to file a harassment claim, or to move to the claim at that point. What we find, though, is that so often in organizations, people's unwillingness to confront these issues directly and hold the crucial conversations leaves them all to escalate either to claims or to somebody quitting to get away from the behavior and moving on somewhere else. So We have tremendous influence through crucial conversations if we are willing to exercise that influence.
Now, if she were in, let's say in that case, you know, the man was behaving badly,
yeah,
and her approach to the conversation would essentially, you know, one way to do it would be to confront him and say, I think you're a lech, and I think you're, you know, harassing me, and I think, you know, I think this and that. Another approach would be to simply say, here's what I'm observing. Here are the facts as I see them. You know, go ahead. No, you go ahead.
Oh, there are three different places you can begin when you're starting to share your concerns in a crucial conversation. One is with your feelings. And this is one of the, I think, worst pieces of advice that we've passed around. We say, begin by sharing your feelings and share them as I messages. So I feel kind of disrespected, or I feel, you know, badly or hurt in our relationship with one another. It turns out in crucial conversations, if you begin by sharing your feelings, you create confusion and defensiveness, not clarity and openness. So this is the worst place to begin, and even a gimmick like sharing I messages is not going to get you past the defenses. The second place that you could begin is with your conclusions or judgments, your story in essence. So I could share with this other person that, you know, sometimes when we're talking, I get the feeling that you're sort of checking me out or flirting or looking at my body or something like this. Again, bad place to begin. As you're suggesting, Jack, what we found works the best is to begin with the facts. So as this lady shared her concerns, she began just by saying, sometimes when we're talking, you begin sort of looking at my eye level, but then your eyes sort of drift down along my body during the conversation. Now, I don't know what you're looking at. Sometimes your eyes will even rest sort of about this level, and she motions with her hands sort of about chest level. She's being very careful not to share her conclusions, just to share the facts. Now, he became a little bit defensive when she did that, and she had to use another skill that we describe in the book called stepping out of the content of the conversation and recreating safety. Remember earlier we talked about learning to look, and when others are moving to silence or violence, that means they don't feel safe. So you set the issue aside for just a moment and restore safety, and then when you watch their shoulders relax and their eyes sort of come back to yours and they're into the conversation again, and then you can move back to the issue. So I notice your eyes sort of resting at this level, and now I can start to share my conclusions or my judgments, but I do so tentatively. So the place to begin is with the facts, not with feelings and not with judgments or conclusions, but with the facts.
We have another call to talk with. Let's include them in our conversation. Another Urbana listener on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning. Very interesting. I tuned in late, so I don't know if if the book is about crucial conversations in the workplace, or how about crucial conversations in a family environment?
Do you have a particular crucial conversation in mind in the family environment?
Well, yes, actually, I do. I have a young friend who I've known for many years, and she is having trouble being in school, getting her work done. And I'm just thinking how to talk to her in a way so that I'm heard and she doesn't feel judged. I'm hearing that she's not getting... This is a very smart young woman.
Mm.
So I'm, you know, I'm sort of, you know, like an older friend to her, and I want to be supportive, but I think she's hurting herself a lot by her inattention to school and her absences from school, and so I just want to know how to approach it.
You know, one of the things first of all, I really appreciate your motivation around this. She's lucky to have a friend like you.
Thank you.
The direct answer to your question about the book is about half of it deals with these kinds of at-home conversations,
mm-hmm,
and with friends and loved ones, and then about half more in a professional setting. The biggest challenge in creating safety, and this is what I hear you asking for, how do I help her to feel safe so that I can be very direct with her, and yet she's not going to feel like I'm here to sort of control her or just sort of impose my will.
Or criticize.
Yes. The place to begin a crucial conversation is not with the issue, it's with the goals. Start by describing your goals in the conversation, what you do and don't want. And if I could have tape-recorded what you just said, that would have been a perfect way to begin this conversation. You know, I've got some kind of concerns I'd like to talk with you about, but you know what, I don't want to do it in a way that is going to put you on your guard or make you feel like that I'm trying to control you here or do something to you in your life. And if you share what you do and don't want to have happen in just as genuine a way as you just did, my guess is that she'll probably feel a little bit safe and be a little bit open to what you want to share in the conversation. So that's sort of point number one. Point two is the best place to begin that conversation is by trying to explore what's important to her. To the degree you can find where she's feeling pain in her life that's connected with the concern that you want to raise, you'll be far more effective.
Could you say that again?
To the degree you can find where in her life she's feeling pain that's connected to the concern that you want to raise, then you'll be far more effective in helping her to hear it, if that's your motivation for sharing it. So, for example, if her getting poor grades or missing classes at school is creating stress in her relationship with her parents or guardians, then if part of your reason for raising it is, you know what, I think I know some ways that you can have a much more positive and supportive relationship with your guardian or with your parent there, And I'd like to share these, and they might be a little tough for us to discuss. But if we can get through it, I bet there are ways that that relationship will be so much better, and you'll have more freedom and more support from them. So my first challenge is to think to myself, is this issue that I want to raise connected in some very direct way to some pain that they are experiencing in their life? Now my motivation for raising it is both my needs and interests, but also I can raise it for you, to help you.
So would I just ask her directly? Is her, you know, cutting school, poor attendance, is it related to some personal problem?
If you don't know her well enough that you can see that that it's creating problems for her that she cares about, then that can be a first point in the conversation, is to sort of discuss with her that that these are issues that you notice, and without you imposing any of your judgments on her, just asking, is that working for you? You know, is that getting you where you want to go? And you know what? The bottom line is that if at the end of that, she really thoughtfully and honestly says, yeah, when I cut school and get poor grades or, you know, sort of neglect my studies, it actually creates a better life for me, then you're done. You really, at that point, are going to have to move the conversation to a bargaining one, as opposed to you helping her solve one of her problems.
What's a bargaining conversation?
Bargaining one. I get to this plenty of time with my kids, and I have a couple that are very studious and a couple that are not so studious.
Mm-hmm.
So the conversation turns more to me saying, you know what, something that's very important to me is you putting yourself in a position to have a lot of options later in your life, and getting good grades and doing well in school opens some doors up that you may want to take advantage of at a later time. I know that doesn't matter much to you right now, and that's okay. I'm okay with that, but it matters
to me. I'd rather play and be with my friends.
Yes, and you know what? I really want you to be able to play and be with your friends, and so let's make a deal. You know, let's create a way that you can play and be with your friends and accomplish this other goal. And you need to know that this other goal is so important to me that I'm not willing to walk away from this conversation without a plan that's going to achieve that one. I'm also not willing to walk away from this conversation without a plan that is going to give you freedom and flexibility to play with your friends. I want both of those. How about you? So I'm trying to create what we call a mutual purpose. I want to help them see that I'm very firm on achieving the goals that I want to achieve. And at the same time, I'm also very firm on helping them to achieve the goals that are important to them. So mutual purpose is half of what creates safety in a conversation. You can be very candid about your desire to achieve your goals as long as you are equally committed to helping them achieve theirs. They'll give you permission to do that.
What's the name of your book again, please?
It's called Crucial Conversations, Tools for Talking When Stakes Are High.
And your name, sir?
It's Joseph Granny. And yours?
Myrna. And
Myrna.
What's your last name? G-R-A?
G-R-E-N-N-Y.
G-R-E-N-N-Y. And it's available now?
It should be just about any bookstore you want to go to.
And is it in paperback, by the way?
It is. It's in paperback. And, in fact, if you go to Amazon, I think it's 30% off. So.
Oh, my goodness.
Get it very inexpensively.
G-R-E-N-N-Y.
Uh-huh.
Crucial Conversations.
Yes.
Thank you. This has been most enlightening.
Well, Verna, good luck to you. She's got a good friend in you, and I hope you'll have that conversation.
Thank you.
Bye. All right. Thanks for the call. Well, I sort of feel like I was neglecting my duties as a host if people didn't know the name of the guest or the book.
I knew them both.
All right. I'll repeat them again, and we're out of time, so we're going to have to stop. I'm sorry to say there's a lot more we could talk about that's in the book. The title is Crucial Conversations, Tools for Talking When Stakes Are High, and it's published by McGraw-Hill. Our guest, Joseph Grenny, G-R-E-N-N-Y, is one of four co-authors of the book. And also, there's a website associated with the book. Is that right?
There is. One of the things that we've learned about crucial conversations is that you can't get better at them alone. So we really encourage people, if they're going to work on this, and it's such a pivotal skill area, if you want to work on it, get a copy of the book, go to the website, and there are some exercises, even video clips you can use. The first one to take, go right to crucialconversations.com and take the Stylander stress test. and figure out sort of where you're starting in a particular conversation, and it will help you target exactly those parts of the book that will move you forward in a conversation that matters to you.
Okay. Well, Joseph Grinney, thanks so much for talking with us. It's been very interesting. And that was an archive presentation of a show that aired on October 7th, 2002, dipping deep back into the archives. And by the way, all of our shows are on our website in archival form in both real audio streaming and MP3 downloads. Actually, MP3s for the past 2.5 years, I believe. Before that, it was just real audio. So if there's any show that you missed or you just want to explore shows in the past, you can go to our website, will.uiuc.edu, and click on Listen, and you'll be presented with a whole menu of choices about Focus 580, the Afternoon Magazine, the Agricultural Program, Sidetrack. All the other shows that we air, that we produce locally, are on our website in archival form, something that we hope that you take advantage of. That's it for this hour of Focus 580. We will, in about 10 minutes, return with Rich Warren, who is our expert on consumer electronics. We'll talk about what's new in consumer electronics, and we'll do that in just a few minutes.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from Strawberry Fields in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields Catering Department now offers boxed lunches for professional meetings or casual lunchtime gatherings. Strawberry Fields, 328-1655.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Bungie North America in Danville. Bungie recognizes the importance of agricultural production to our society and economy and the role producers and processors play in providing food and feed to the world.
And with this update on agriculture coming up on 10:58 Central Time, I'm Jay Pierce. Well, as we look at the wheat contracts, we see some upward motion here in Kansas City. The July contract at 501 is up 15.25 right now. July wheat on the Chicago Board of Trade is at 412.5, up 9. September at 425.5 is up 10. July corn at 259.25 is up 1/4. September at 270.25, up 1/4. December up 0.5 at 283.5. And the March 2007 corn contract at 292.75 is up 1/4. July soybeans 603.5, up 3/4. August at 609.5, up 1/4. September at 614.5, up 3/4. November at 624.5, down 1/4. July soybean meal 176.90, up 70. And July oil at 25.69, down 2. The May feeder cattle 103.65, down 20. June live cattle down 20 at 77.45. Lean hogs for June at